Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. And welcome back to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. This is Lori, and I am here with Zachary Carr, PhD.
Woo, woo, woo! And also, I can call you, can I call you Aunt Lori?
You can, yes.
You're not really my aunt, though.
I know, but I am honorary.
We have to get the disclaimer. We're like honorary family members.
We are family, but not, anyway, yes.
It's okay. We've known each other for a very long time.
Right. Zach was 4 at my wedding. How's that?
There you go.
Literally, I have video evidence of him dancing at my wedding.
It's a sight. It was beautiful. I remember it vividly.
Sure you do. I'm so sure.
Everybody has. Deception.
But people can't see you, so they're missing all
that's
the information.
True. That's true. But that's not the only reason I'm here.
No.
Not just because we're family.
Correct.
Can I introduce myself now?
Please do.
Okay. So yes, my name is Zach, and I do have my PhD. I'm a clinical assistant professor at the University of Buffalo. I got my undergraduate there in 2013, master's in 2015, PhD in 2019. And I'll make this even more relevant. I study nonverbal communication, specifically deception.
Dun, 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 dun.
So I study how people lie. Which I'm sure many of your listeners are like, oh, that's why he's here, not just because of his crazy cool dance moves. And so I study deception, and I look at particularly nonverbal cues that manifest when people are lying. A lot of people think that means just facial expressions or body language, which it does. But I also look at things like what we call paralinguistic cues, tone of voice, speech errors, all those types of things. So that's my area of expertise. I worked, stop me if I ramble
no, go.
For too
this
long.
This is important.
I worked under Dr. Mark Frank, who is probably the, I would say, top 3 leading experts on deception in the world. That's not even a dramatic statement. They just did a documentary where it was about con artists. It's very cool. I forget the name of it, which is a terrible marketing strategy, but it's really cool. And he's an incredible, incredible researcher, mentor. So I trained under him. And then from there, I kind of blossomed into my own understanding of deception. And so I am currently a professor, a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Communication at the University of Buffalo. So I do primarily teaching now. But in addition to that, a lot of my work, I do a lot of consulting with law enforcement agencies, various other groups that bring me in, security firms. I even work with some doctors on detecting things like fake pain. But I work with, I've worked with TSA, Border Patrol. I've worked with state Supreme Court judges. Any field, really, where lying can happen, where people can be deceptive, which is pretty much every field.
But where it matters, where we really need to figure it out.
Yeah, because humans, all of us kind of do that. Thing.
No.
I know. Shocking. I think your viewers might find that a very, very dramatic statement. So I consult with a number of groups and have done so for a very long time and love it. What else? I've been published in the Journal of Nonverbal Communication. It was my first publication and I love it dearly. And it's called, if you want to look it up, it's called How People Really Suspect and Discover Lies.
Ooh, very interesting.
It's a nice title. I was really proud of it. I wanted to go with what's behavior got to do with it. Like, what's love got to do? But it didn't. No one else wanted that. So there.
So you just opened the door for me to comment on. So Zach essentially has 2 full-time careers.
I do.
So not only is he Professor Man, but he is also a locally renowned vocalist.
That's a very...
named the top male vocalist
jazz
of the
male
year.
Vocalist. We got to be. I don't want to take anything away from my rock brothers and sisters and all that. But yes, that's very kind of you. I have been 4 years now in a row. Best voted, you know, audience. They are very careful about how they award it, but it's something along the lines of best jazz.
He's a fan favorite.
Yes, there we go. Okay. So I do a lot of that. I sing, I coach singing. So I do have two lives, which is wild.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because my nonverbal work, actually I've also started to cultivate that in the singing realm with performing, you know, flipping the script instead of trying to catch liars. I've been working on helping performers become more authentic on stage by using their facial expressions and body language. So,
well, that's cool.
It's depressing to work with liars so much. And so you need a little break. You have to balance that out every once in a while.
And sort of investing in the young people really is an encouraging place to be.
It's a great place to be. So I do a lot of work with youth and coaching youth, and it's been a great joy of my life. And teaching at the college level too is just a wonderful way to work that out. My other little credential of credibility maybe would be, I'm also the first author on a chapter, International Handbook of Deceptive Communication, and it's called Why Methods Matter. So that text explores how we conduct research on deception detection, which is really what it's called, many things, but deception detection is one of them. So did I cover it all? I think I was chaotic and all that.
But... You were not. But if anybody doubts whether or not Zach has the credentials to speak into this truth, I think that has been put to rest.
Cool.
There you go.
I want to make sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's very important.
But it's a really interesting field. And I've been very blessed and grateful to work with people like Mark, who I should also say, you know, UB didn't send me here to talk to you about this today. I'm here on my own volition. There's going to be someone out there that's like, oh, UB is getting involved in this. No, it's not the case. I just care very much about this topic. This is a topic that has also touched my family, has been tough for us to walk through, and we can revisit that later. Mm-hmm. So I have some personal experience with, I think, the theme of this podcast. And so I'm here because I think it's the right thing to do, and I think it's important to inform people of deception in general, but also how things like this can
possibly happen.
How can they happen? And it's something I ask myself as someone who studies deception. I still ask myself, how is it that this can happen, and how can so many people be, I don't want to say fooled, but how can we be deceived, and not just one-on-one, which is a lot of deception detection studying is one-on-one, me sitting here across from you in line, but not just interpersonally, but on a group level as well. So,
And that really is what we were thinking when we thought about inviting Zach to join us, because there, of course, so many people are saying, how is it possible? I have neighbors of this person for 30 years. I've sat in church with this person. This person counseled me for years. Like, how could I have been so fooled? So Zach, how could we all have been so fooled?
Oh goodness. What a question. and I should say, everyone asks me all the time, are you really great at lying, or do you know when people are lying? It's no, I've gotten better at it, but the thing, so I think the first place to start is to unpack what can we look for in the easiest context, which is like one-on-one. But I got to say right off the bat, a couple of disclaimers. A lot of people think that deception detection is this kind of parlor trick or magic show where I see something, I see a nose twitch, and I go, oh, they're lying. Not how it works, sadly. I wish it worked like that, but it's not how it works. There is no quote unquote Pinocchio's nose to line. There's just not one cue, we call it, that manifests the same for everybody in the same context. And so first, don't feel too bad, all you wonderful listeners, because there is really no, like I said, there's no Pinocchio's nose that automatically says that person is lying. That's the first thing right off the bat.
Let me just comment on that, because that is something that I referenced in the How Do We Keep Our Kids Safe episode, that if we're sitting around thinking that we're going to be able to know just by looking and meeting someone whether they're safe or not safe, that's not a certain science, is what you're saying. We have to equip our children to use their voice, and we have to listen when they use it.
Absolutely. It's certainly not a certain science. And in fact, the field itself is a hot one, if I may say. And there are things we do know. And so one of those is that there's no Pinocchio's nose. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that we're not capable of detecting deception. And one of the things that's really important, and you and I were talking about this before, is that you have to understand the concept of baseline behavior, not just interpersonally, and we'll come back to this as we go on, but in a group context as well, of baseline behavior and how one's behavior might deviate from their norm. And how it does that is really a huge chunk of how we're detecting deception when it comes to scientifically, when it comes to law enforcement, all of the above, is looking at deviations from the baseline behavior.
So you were mentioning before when we were talking about it, maybe repeat it for the listeners,
I would love to.
About law enforcement and statistically how good law enforcement is at this and who's best at it.
Yes. So it's a good place to unwind. All of us are bad at it. And generally the literature will suggest that we're about a coin flip.
Wow.
Let that sink in. You know, we really are about 50%, 54% on a good day, depending on which meta-analyses you look at, right? Law enforcement, love law enforcement. I work with many of them, with the exception of a few agencies, which is a fun side fact that we can get into. Also, law enforcement, right off the cuff, right off the bat, are not incredibly adept either at detecting deception. It gets a little better. You know, we get into the 58, 59, 60% realm, right? But like the idea of, and I'm talking, by the way, I'm not talking about taking a case to trial. I'm talking about one-on-one. They're watching someone lie. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm talking about.
Do they catch it?
Do they catch it in the moment? And we've done studies. There's studies on this, right? Where they'll show, you know, let's say 15 video clips to, you know, detectives, for example. And sometimes, you know, you get roughly around that 58, 59, 60% realm, right? However, there are a couple law enforcement agencies that are really good, or better, I should say, at it. And I was mentioning this before, you know, agencies like the Secret Service tend to show higher than average detection rates. And when you think about what they do for a living, some of them, the ones that are particularly good are the ones that are tasked with you know, the classic guarding politicians, right, at public events. If you think about what their job is to scan the crowd and look for deviations from the baseline. They're looking for things that, which of these things does not fit. And so when you're doing that over and over and over again, you know, you're cultivating that skill. They do pretty well. Some CIA operatives do really well. You tend to see some judges actually can score pretty high because they get a wealth of evidence to practice on, if you will, or a plethora of data. So generally,
so let me just comment on that quick. Yeah. So if you think about what Zach's saying there, what he's saying is that if you're a judge in a courtroom and you now are reading a person and cueing into kind of what are the deviations and how they're operating. And then, oh, by the way, you get to hear evidence to the veracity of their statements. Now you're putting together, this is what I saw, this is what I thought, and this is what I now learned.
It's powerful.
Yeah.
And if you do it over and over and over again, you cultivate a practice that is good. I mean, you become better at it, you know? So
we say it this way, neurons that fire together, wire together. The more I use a neural pathway, the more fluid that pathway becomes.
What a double-edged sword that can be.
Oh, huh? Yep.
What a double-edged sword that can be. But yeah, so it's important for us to recognize that human nature, we do tend to have, I don't want to say a truth bias, but we are not adept at outright detection. There are, we call them wizards. There are a small chunk of the population that are able to detect, you know, really well. We talked about this at lunch too, Laurie, but you know, think of it this, it's kind of this idea, like, Lori, I think my cousins, Jonah, or I don't know.
That's okay.
Can I say their names?
Yeah.
Okay, yep. Great. You know when they call, like, hey, mom, and they're like, you know it's off.
Yes.
How do you know that?
I could just tell what their voice should sound like, what it sounds like on a good day, mm-hmm. and what it sounds like on a meh day, and what it sounds like on a bad day.
Exactly. Through how many years, though, of experience? Too many.
Too many. I'm tired.
We love you all. But that's kind of my point is that, you know, most of us, when we're looking at someone for 5 minutes that we've never met, that's tough. You know, that's tough to really make a good determination about what's happening. However, you know, the more experience you have with certain people, the more you start to track those things. But mm-hmm. I went off on a little tangent there. But
no, but that's important.
Generally, we're not great at it. However, with time, with cultivation, with practice, some populations can do decently on that.
So maybe you can comment on, so we've also heard, and this has been true throughout my career, so many times I sat with people who were now trying to unpack an abuse experience. Mm-hmm. Often it's a parent whose child was abused, that I so many times hear, everybody always told us that, you know, Uncle Frank was creepy and mm-hmm. that, you know, we always heard these things, like he did these weird things, but we just dismissed it. And now they're having to apologize to their child and resolve their own guilt and regret for not taking that seriously. But maybe you can talk about, like, what is that about? Why do we do that?
Okay. So there is this interesting, I guess, elevation that occurs when we go from one-on-one deception to more group-oriented deception, whether it's a family, whether it's a particular work environment, whatever it may be,
a church, a community,
there's something that happens in the way we process information. And there's an interesting facet of human nature to be discovered there, right? Interpersonally, if I may kind of backtrack for a second, interpersonally, for those that are interested, I always like to dispel a couple myths, if that's okay.
Yeah,
if
please.
I can, I'll get to your question, I promise.
Okay.
If you're like, hey, Zach, any cool tips for catching, you know, a liar? And so I don't. No, I do. But there are some things that we want to understand. You know, there's common misconceptions about deception. One of them is, for example, eye contact. Everyone thinks that if you break eye contact when you're telling a story in a particular way, that means you're lying. In actuality, it's about 50-50. And so there was an interesting study done, it's called by the Global Deception Research Team, where they surveyed 17 countries and asked them, what's the number one cue someone's lying? Everyone said eye contact. But the literature suggests that it's really half and half sometimes, but it comes from this idea of, you know, it stems from neurolinguistic programming, which has some really solid roots, became very popular, I think, with the movie The Negotiator with Samuel L. Jackson. And the FBI Academy taught it for a while, but in reality, deception is so complex and involves so many different constructs that, you know, the idea of looking up into the right or left, whatever it may be, as an indicator that you're lying, or breaking eye contact in a conversation that you're lying, it really doesn't hold much water, especially when you look at things like culture. Mm-hmm. Different cultures avoid eye contact more than others, you know, particularly more Eastern cultures. Also, if I just stared at somebody for longer than like 3 or 4 seconds, it's weird.
Creepy.
It's very weird. So you have to, you know, breaking eye contact is a normal functionality of human conversation, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. But going back to what to look for, you know, baseline behavior is the thing to track. And so there are some things that you can look for. For example, what we tend to see with liars is that illustrators go down. Illustrators are hand movements that we make when we're talking. So due to the increased cognitive load that can come when someone's telling a fabrication, which can involve sometimes checking to see if you believe my lie, it can make me keeping track of my own story, then trying to also regulate my autonomic response systems. All of that is what we call cognitive load, and that can increase. And what you tend to see is, I call it like a buttoning down of the hatches, as it were, like a clamping down, almost like the human body starts to shrink into it. You can't see me right now, but I'm doing this shrinking motion. And it's almost like everything starts to become less and less,
smaller
and smaller and smaller. and there's less expressivity, you know, as opposed to if I'm sitting, as I'm sitting now talking to Lori, my legs are a little bit further apart. My hands are moving a mile a minute. I swear, I think I'm Italian sometimes. I'm not, I'm Polish. And so this starts to go into this more reserved, clamped down state. And you tend to see that, especially if there's a good interviewer present who can recognize some of that. So you tend to see this like the body almost shuts down a little bit.
Makes tons of sense.
And that's one of those really unique signs that isn't talked about as much. Sometimes what you will see are what we call manipulators or adapters. These are the classic ones of like the scratching of your nose or the biting of your lip. That was very famous in the Bill Clinton trial that happened where he scratched his nose a lot. And it sometimes is a useful indicator of deception. However, it can also be misleading because people who are telling the truth can feel uncomfortable. When we feel uncomfortable, there's something called erectile tissue that's inside the lining of your nose there, also in your ear. That flares up when you experience extreme emotional arousal, which then triggers a physiological arousal. And then you have to itch it. You have to scratch it. So yes, that can happen if someone's lying, but be wary. It can also happen for someone who's just being uncomfortable. They might just be nervous, right? And so the trick is, if you're talking about a particular topic and you see no scratching of the nose, no scratching of the ear, and then you get to a topic and all of a sudden they're itching the heck out of their nose, like I just did, that's something you might want to pursue further.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense, because it's a deviation.
A deviation from the baseline. And we call those deviations, by the way, for those keeping notes, we call them hotspots.
Okay.
It's a really wonderful term that our lab, Dr. Mark Frank, coined. And it basically, think of them as red flags.
Right.
You know, the more red flags you see, now you can be certain that, whoa, we might have some deception going on here. One or two, be careful. But the more red flags you see, okay, we want to pursue that. So when we consult with law enforcement or private agencies, we're really teaching them how to recognize those hotspots and then steer the questions to get more of them, to unravel, right? So, you know, yes or no questions don't really do it, right? They're not helpful, right? It's the questions where you let the possible deceiver really talk and unravel that you start to really see some of these truly rich signs come out. So that's hopefully not too much of a...
No, that's interesting.
Okay, cool.
I think people will find that interesting.
Feel free to unpack that more.
Okay.
This is cool because I know I've listened to the whole podcast, but I don't know it's cool to come in from this angle. You know, because you know, you obviously have a different perspective than I do on this whole essence of the podcast. So please feel free to stop me and clarify. But that's what I call interpersonal deception.
Mm-hmm.
To get back to your question of how can this escape so many people? This is where things get more uncomfortable, I think. So stop me if I go too rah at people. Part of what makes deception work on a group level is it's a number of things, but one of those things is that we look at a scenario or a scene or whatever it might be, a particular context, and we want to believe that scene is operating the way it should be.
We want it to, right?
We want to be like, everything's fine here. Nothing to see. Let me move along.
Nothing I have to be stressed about or worried about or mad about or whatever yucky feelings.
And that right there, what you just described, is one of the researchers would call it an evolutionary lens for understanding group deception. Now, I want to clarify, when we say evolutionary lens, I do not suggest, I'm not talking about the origins of humankind. I'm talking about how we've evolved as a species over thousands of years or hundreds of thousands, depending on who you ask. And what are some of the human traits that simultaneously allow us to survive, but also are not helpful? Let me really state, are not helpful when it comes to situations like what we're talking about in this podcast, when it comes to politics, when it comes to belief in general. So there are traits and characteristics that are very useful for the human species to survive, but really are detrimental when it comes to these darker areas that aren't just life and death necessarily. And so one of those that you mentioned is one of the reasons we look at a situation or a scene and say, nothing to see here. I don't have to expel any more energy. reevaluating is because if we were confronted, or if when we are confronted with information that can contradict our worldview, our perception of what is right, what is good, when we're presented with that information, we have two choices. And now we're getting, by the way, side note, we're getting a little bit into the realm of processing now. We're not just talking about deception anymore, but how we process information. Mm-hmm. And we're presented with two choices. Our first choice, the more convenient choice, the one that sadly most of us, myself included, will engage in, is to put our fingers in our ears and go, la, 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 nothing to see. And I'm going to just put my head in the sand and mm-hmm. keep moving on. We do that because the other choice, the other option, involves us having to be, having to confront the information in a way that's honest. And if we honestly confront that information, it might lead to decisions we have to make that we don't like.
Or we have to live with the fact that we're not willing to make those decisions.
Or that. That could be a third option.
Which feels terrible too.
Which also feels terrible. Either of those are less taxing on the psyche than just saying or pretending that everything's fine, right? Mm-hmm. You and I were talking about this at lunch, Lori, but it comes down to resources as well. You know, when I, and if I stop me if I go too far here, but you know, in a case, let's say hypothetically, similar to the one we're talking about, if I, you know, if I go to a church and I give of my time every Sunday to that church, it's my, you know, it's some good faith, yes, but also some, for some people, it's just social membership. And I do that and I pay my lip service and that's good, but I give my hour and that's important to me. And I need to make sure that people see me doing it.
My identity is tied up in, look at me, I'm a good church person. Yep.
That's my belief system, because now, you know, especially in 2022, so much of our beliefs are tied to our identity, which is good and also bad. When you are presented with information that can literally give you a system meltdown or a system failure to that way of living, we have a hard time with that, you know, because then it means I have to reevaluate that I've been going to church here, or I've been doing this thing, or I've been believing in this particular ideology. I mean, look at politics right now in 2022, you know, and so when we're presented with contradictory information, the tougher choice is so tough because it really requires us to evaluate everything. It's like when you get out of a bad relationship and you're like, well, why didn't you break up with them sooner? Because I spent 6 years in that relationship. I gave all this energy and time. I should keep on fighting, when really the answer might be no. You gave that time. All right, get out. You know, and right. So there's this idea of, I need to keep the path. I need to keep everything intact in my worldview, this image that I have out in the world. And when I'm presented with bits of information that contradict that, That's tough for a lot of us to process.
Well, we tend to try to avoid chaos. We tend to try to avoid any kind of discomfort and to face the truth that I've been deceived and I didn't see something that maybe I think I should have seen or whatever. That creates a certain amount of chaos in our world.
We don't like that. No. There's a theory called uncertainty reduction theory, which there's a lot of tenets, but pretty much it just says humans are obsessed with reducing uncertainty.
Truth.
We don't like it.
Nope.
We don't like it. And it can manifest, by the way, in so many ways. And I think relevant to this you know, situation with Kate and everything that we're walking through is when you have, you know, people are like, well, how did I not notice? And I hate to say this, it's because on some level, we really don't want to notice.
Right.
We don't want to notice when situations are going south. Mm-hmm. Because if they are, particularly with something like a church, for example, where it's literally able to survive because of membership, if you will. It needs people. If all those people have reasons why they're going to that particular church, mm-hmm. whatever those reasons may be, they're important to them. They chose to give their time to that church, not to somewhere else, right? And so those reasons are really important. And when we start to feel like that's important to us, anything else that might contradict that pathway sets up a system failure, you know? And so we at some level don't like to be presented with the idea that something might be going wrong. And in my own personal experience with this happened, I won't name particular places or names, but this happened where when we were going through a similar situation in my family, I was astounded looking back on it now. This happened when I was younger. I was astounded that no one stepped in at places that should have stepped in and said, hold on here, what's going on? And the reason is because the alternative would have caused way more chaos. To use more ambiguity and chaos, it would have been harder to directly, explicitly confront that this was happening. So it's easier to just quote unquote rationalize through little cues that might set off alarm bells. We're just like, well, no, maybe it's just a misunderstanding. Maybe, they must have gotten that wrong. There's no way.
It couldn't have been that bad.
No, there's no way that, and at the end of the day, it's really, there's no way that where I choose to give my time, the people I choose to interact with, there's no way that they could be capable of this. Because if they are, then what does that say about me?
So Zach and I took a couple second break, and in that time we were just sort of talking.
In the midst of some technical difficulties.
A little bit of technical challenge. That's okay, right? We figured out about the situation Zach referenced earlier. So that situation was basically that there it was many years ago. A family member who was found to be having sexually abused one of the girls in the family, his family member. And what we were talking about is that the person who was named as the abuser was actively involved in a church. I know we're all stunned by that, shocked and appalled. What? How could this happen? But yes, was actively involved, was all the things we're talking about, was teaching Sunday school, teaching middle school,
yes.
Sunday school. And when this information emerged and was brought to the attention of the church leaders, he was not removed from his role. Now, again, mind you, this information was brought to the leadership with credibility. Mm-hmm. And to the best of our knowledge, up until at least a few years ago, to our knowledge, he was still attending that church and also still leading in some ways.
As far as I know, yeah. I mean, at the very least, what I do know for a certainty is that I don't know how recent that has continued for, but I do know that since this event happened over a decade ago, he remained in a position of leadership for a much longer period than should have ever have been. I know that. I mean, we are talking years.
Right.
And so, but this is exactly, I think, what we're talking about. I mean, we can merge all the worlds here. I think you have to ask yourself why and how. Well, the alternative is harder. I mean, really, it's not in the end, but we can kick the can down the road.
Yes.
You know, I can kick the can down the road. We can just be like, well, okay. And we can keep toeing the line for years and years and years. And in some cases, there's never any resolution, but it's harder to explicitly address the conflict in the moment. We don't like conflict, right. But if we can, this type of conflict though, is just, it's always in the shadows. And when it's in the shadows, we don't seek to find it. And we don't want to feel, that's why I go a reference again, we don't want to have our worldview or our perception, I say worldview in the sense of our lifestyle, our mm-hmm. image, whatever that might be, our belief systems, we don't want to have those threatened because that's our sense of self. And that applies to everyone involved. It's not just the explicit perpetrator.
Right.
And sometimes people that are on the receiving end of the deception or the abuse, whatever it might be, once they start to kind of get a clue like something's up, then they become complicit mm-hmm. because they don't want to address it. So now they've gone from being just the receiving end to actually being an enabler, if you will. It probably isn't the right term.
Well, that's the term we've used.
Okay, great. Not my area of expertise, mm-hmm. but the enabler now. So now they're complicit. They've gone from being the receiver of the deception to now aiding in the deception.
And so anyone who listened to the second wound episode knows this concept well, that's what we're referring to here. And the second wound that our family experienced, your family experienced as a result of the failure of the leaders in that church to stand with the victim, mm-hmm. survivor, is in many ways found to be so much, almost more huge than the original wounding itself, because it is become so pervasive, mm-hmm. right? So now it's not just this person hurt me. Now it's, I can't trust all these people because they don't care.
It's an extended network. It's a web.
Right.
And this is what Kate is experiencing. I don't want to speak about it. It sounds like that's
absolutely
what Kate's experiencing. And that's what, I mean, on in my family, on the perpetrator's side, his family just left us, left us.
With and no regard.
For anyone listening that's on the other side of the family, love you all.
My side of the family,
yes,
I'm just saying.
Love you all. But they left us. I mean, it was the same thing. It was family that I had known, we had known for, I mean, 16, 17 years, that holidays and all these things. So it's powerful for all of the listeners out there to really just do a little bit of soul searching just in their own lives and say, there's no way that if this came up that I would engage in this. And I hope not, but I can tell you from personal experience and from my own professional work that, and I'm sure you can too, there are instances where it's not just even the church is bad enough, but there are family members, as we know from this, that will turn the, you know, the blind eye, as it were, sometimes complicit, but in both ways being complicit. So it's,
and recognizing though, that there's a price to pay either way. Right.
Yep.
So the people that walked away from you guys, they paid a huge price. They paid a price because now they will live forever knowing that they had a moment where they could have stepped into the gap and done something meaningful and worthy with their time and energy, but they said no. And and by the way, they've missed the opportunity to watch you guys grow up and become, and that's too bad for them.
Yeah. Thank you. I think so.
Yeah, totally.
But it's you know, to circle this back, we have to really, you have to develop a healthy respect for the power that is our own processing. And we have to really be very mindful of what we are willing to engage in to keep the internal peace, right? And so there's this really interesting concept. There's a number of theoretical models, by the way, that we can throw out there. There's impression management that comes from, you know, communicative sociological literature.
So what does that mean?
The idea that there's a number of tenets, right? The idea that we we can, feel free to chime in with your own take on this, but the idea that we can manage not only how we present ourselves to the exterior, but then how we perceive how others present themselves to us, and then how that impacts our own lives, right? And so the compensatory ways in which we'll make up for defaults we might see in other people, right? And so it comes both ways, sender and receiver.
So, okay, so you're making me think about what we've said many times before, is that if pedophiles looked like pedophiles, they wouldn't be very good at their job. They would not have access to children.
Absolutely.
So they go way out of their way to be volunteer in the community and
kind.
Super helpful and kind and
appearing to be extroverted.
Yes.
And absolutely.
Those things.
Yeah. There's an acute awareness. And this is something about deception and deceiving the masses, that there is a studying that occurs where what does a truth teller look like? That's a really wild thing to unpack, but you know, you can look at impression management theories and ideas to get that, but what does a truth teller look like? Or what do I expect from a truth teller? And then I try to emulate that, right? Then I try to replicate that, and I not just do it one time, I do it three times. If I'm deceptive.
Got it.
Right? Which makes deception detection wildly chaotic. Talk about chaos, right?
But because they're copycatting.
They're copycatting all day. And some do it better than others. But I mean, if you study something long enough and you get enough practice at it, and here's the other thing, if you are successful, even on a small level, if I can deceive one person, even in a conversation about something meaningless, that little snowflake built into a massive giant snowball of confidence. And confidence, by the way, is something we all love. Mm-hmm. We love confidence. And this stems into another, if I may go real theoretical again, something called the elaboration likelihood model, which is this idea we process things two ways. We process things centrally, or we process them in this peripheral way. And one of the tenets of the peripheral route of processing is this idea that we are absolutely obsessed with confidence, extroversion, attractiveness, perceived credibility. You could wrap the most garbage statement in beautiful packaging and people will buy it.
Absolutely.
If you present it in a way that gets past all the perceptive barriers. And this is, so I'm going through all this not to like bore everybody, but these are all ways in which we understand how humans process information, how we send information. We need to start applying this to situations like what Kate's going through. And so, I mean, it's, I when I lecture, I make sure that every lecture when in person has the most incredible amount of, I mean, it's pretty much who I am as a speaker. It's pretty genuine, to be honest with you, but I know that if I have a bad day lecturing, like I've stumbled 17 times, but my energy's high, most people won't remember the 17 stumbles.
Huh, interesting.
And I can tell you that that is a very real thing. Charisma is another fun word that people like to throw around, right? And then another concept that this isn't a theory necessarily, I believe it's still hanging out in the hypothesis realm, but the last name of the researcher is Kahan from Yale University, who came up with this concept of motivated reasoning. Which originally was applied to things like politics and ideology. And the idea, he had a really, look, you should all look up this study called Politics Kill Math. And you can go to Google Scholar or just Google it. And really the whole concept is that we will take, this is, you know, along the lines of things like confirmation bias or spinning of information, right? Rebranding information. But we will take information that is contradictory and do our darndest to spin it so that it fits into our current worldview, as opposed to changing the worldview or changing your perspective, right? And so the idea that if I'm presented with this contradicting information, instead of saying, oh, wait a second, I'm wrong, I will A, possibly take that information and spin it somehow to fit, or I will sit there for 5 hours proving that information wrong, even when it's not.
So the way that I think of it, because I work with a lot of kids, is if we remember the scene in Finding Nemo where there's the East Australian current and the current is going really fast and Dory and Nemo are trying to get into the current, they keep getting popped out. We have an existing body of knowledge. And when new information tries to get in, it tends to get popped out because it's very hard to get new information in because of our, we have motivated reasoning. We are reasoning based on a what we are hoping to see and hoping to hear.
Or what we have found that works.
Yeah.
And this is important because what we have to understand is this is, again, the ancient kind of reptilian brain rearing its head over and over again. We think we're so evolved in 2022, and we're really not.
Bottom line, it's about survival.
It is. And hundreds of thousands of years ago, our ancestors utilized these same mechanisms, but they were doing it to literally get food, stay safe, make it to the next day. Right. So I had to make quick judgments. I had to identify friend and foe. I had to maintain the group norm. I had to make sure that I didn't go against the group because groups allowed me safety. Right. Anyone that was outside of that group usually meant me harm. So I had to eliminate that threat. So all of these things have themes, motifs that run through. What's amazing to me and so sadly humorous, I guess, is the way to look at it, is that we take that same idea and now we apply it to beliefs and we apply it to ideology, and we have to be so careful about who is caught in the wake of that and who is caught in the wake of that type of thinking, because really it's survival, and it makes sense when you look at it through a survival lens, but we need to have more nuance today and to recognize that we are still have these ancient mechanisms inside our brainstem. And we have to be very cautious about when they, or be very aware of when they manifest. And that's really what we're playing with here.
That's huge. Because for us to be able to notice that I'm in a flight, fight, freeze moment where I am now feeling panicky, overwhelmed, because now there is this new information that doesn't square with what I want it to look like or what my life looks like. We have to be able to notice when we're there so that we can step back and say, okay, but who am I really? And who am I really going to choose to be? Yep. Am I going to be a person who sits back and allows myself to be cozy and comfortable and not challenge my status quo because this bad thing, if I face it, is going to challenge my status quo? Or am I going to step up and not create a wake behind me that destroys people?
It's the short game versus the long game. And survival mechanisms that allow us to say, nothing to see here, keep on going. They keep the peace for a month and 2 months, maybe 3 months. You can keep kicking the can down the road. You may, I like this, you know, status quo. You maintain the status quo internally. You can help maintain it for your church, for your organization, for your group. It's not the answer when it comes to, it's not the answer at all but it when it gets that long-term game, it will bite you.
Well, okay. So to circle back around to why we're here, you know, when we think about the fact that what we're saying is that sex trafficking, an organized sex trafficking thing is happening right here in our community. The short game is we don't want to deal with that. We don't want to face it. We don't want to talk about it, but that is destroying lives and therefore ultimately destroying our community. And are we okay with that? Hopefully the answer to that is no, but people need to add their voices to Kate's and add their voices to this conversation so that we can now move beyond just, yeah, that's a terrible thing, and move to what are we going to do about it?
Absolutely. And that's what it is. You know, we have to recognize that the threat we feel from acknowledging the situation is really momentary. You know, we look at something like conflict and we ask ourselves like, okay, if I make my voice heard, someone might come at me, you know, okay. Well, okay, but then what's the alternative to that? You know, but we shut down when we think about that explicit addressing.
We get stuck in that moment of, oh no, that will
fight
be bad.
Fight, panic.
Right. But let's think about the empowerment that we feel when we use our voice for purposes that are positive and good. And how about the sense of connectedness that we feel as a society when we work together for overall well-being? There's so many positives that come from that, but that moment of, oh no, it's going to be hard. Yeah, it is going to be hard. That's right. Very little that we ever do that means anything is not hard.
That's right. But it's that moment when you see something and you're like, oh, that, wait, what? And in those 5 seconds of processing, my urging would be to pay attention to those 5 seconds. Fight the urge to just squash it and put it back in the sand. Like fight the urge to kick the can down the road. Recognize why that seemed off to you. And then really recognize that you probably should say something or bring it to someone's attention about that. Don't just be like, oh, that was odd. And then keep going.
Yes.
I mean, that happened with, you know, my family member in question that we're talking, you know, everyone's, he's just quirky. He's just so strange. And then we laughed it off. Laughing of it off was the kicking the can down the road. It was the rationalization of it. It was the burying the head, all of it, multiple times, multiple years. And I know Kate's gone through similar instances.
Absolutely.
And so when we see the thing that deviates from the baseline, really notice it. Really notice it and sit with it. And then possibly make a move on it.
Yeah. Don't kick the can down the road, folks.
Yeah, don't.
That's the takeaway.
It is indeed.
Thank you, Zach.
Well, thank you. I feel like we could unpack so much more.
Ooh, well, maybe we'll have you back on again.
Yeah. If anyone, if anyone wants to ever discuss more of this, there's a lot to unpack with all the brushing broad strokes that we did. So my email is zmcar@buffalo.edu. Please feel free to send me an email anytime, day or night. I love this work.
Oh boy. Here it goes.
Oh, here it goes.
Okay.
And Lori, thanks. Thanks for having me. And I wish you all the strength and peace and love to you and Kate on this journey. So
thank you.
Thank you.
If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.